This is David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement, and you're listening to The Game Changers, Episode 7, Deck the Halls, Part 1. One weekend in October of 2006, a young computer engineer and wannabe designer, we'll call him Don, since that was and is his name, was sitting at home in a bit of a tizzy. For years, he'd been prototyping designs and testing them out on his friends. He'd even worked with Richard Garfield and the team at Wizards of the Coast on the rules revision for Magic the Gathering's 6th edition. Now he was having friends over for games on Monday night, and he was desperate for them to try something new. His most recent design was called Spirit Warriors. Actually, Spirit Warriors 2, because it was his second attempt at a fantasy-themed game. The original Spirit Warriors was a dice chucker, where each player took the role of one of your usual D&D Lord of the Rings character classes, ranger, wizard, thief, and so on. But the game had proved a beast to balance, in large part because it included 500 unique cards, which also made it very labor-intensive to prototype. So pretty quickly, Don moved on to Spirit Warriors Mark II, where he decided to switch things up as much as possible. First, he got rid of the dice, which had the side effect of making the game totally card-dependent. Next, instead of one character, each player would draft a party of four heroes, and each hero would be represented by a packet of 8 to 12 cards. So after drafting, players would shuffle those packets together to make their deck. Incidentally, this is an idea that the folks behind the Smash Up games later took to the bank. Each hero had two skills, and you could level up your heroes to improve those skills. So far, so good. But Don's first draft of Spirit Warriors 2 was way too mathy and fiddly. Players had to do a lot of calculations to figure out their attack strengths, multiplying and adding things on different cards together, and usually getting it wrong. So Don had the idea of having players level up by adding new and better cards into their decks instead of performing strings of calculations. Now, on that weekend in 2006, Don decided to let necessity be the mother of invention. He realized he could make a whole game out of just that one idea, players improving their decks over time. This new game didn't need 500 unique cards, just multiple copies of a small number of cards, which was far, far easier to prototype, print out, and sleeve. The core concept was simple. Everything should be on the cards. Resources, actions, victory points. There was no theme, no storyline, no rhyme or reason. Just the deck. Because it seemed like a cool idea? Players started with decks of 10 cards each. 5 copper cards, each worth $1 worth of purchasing power, and 5 estates, which were originally blank, but then, on a whim, Don decided to make each one worth a victory point each. He whittled down the number of different resources to just one, money. But money cards weren't used up or spent when a player's used them. If he did that, players would end up with tiny decks. No, instead, money cards were like income. The turn you played them, you used them to buy new cards, but then they, along with the cards that you bought, were tossed into your personal discard pile. Then when your draw pile ran out, you shuffled your discards to make a new draw pile, and your coin cards were once again available to be drawn, along with the shiny new cards you had bought. Speaking of which, buying cards, well, a card, was something you got to do every turn automatically. Don didn't want players to have to depend on the cards themselves to give them buying actions. At first, he considered a conveyor belt approach for buying new cards, with them emerging from a main deck and becoming available. But again, Don wanted to avoid penalizing players who had the bad luck not to be able to afford anything on their turn, so he decided on a central market consisting of an assortment of action cards in piles of 12, along with higher denomination money and victory point cards. The original action cards included the following: a mine, which turned copper into silver or silver into gold. 2 different attack cards, one which trashed the top card of everyone else's deck, and one which forced everyone to gain a negative VP card. a card which you could reveal to defend from those attacks, a card which used up your action but gave you two back, which meant you now had an extra action, a card which lets you buy an extra card, a card which lets you trash a card and gain a more expensive one, and a card which gave you your action back, let you draw a card, and gave you an extra virtual buck to spend. Don needed a rule for what happened when one of the piles in the market ran out, and then realized he could just turn that into the endgame trigger. All the cards were in black and white to save on color ink, but Don had a supply of green paper, so he decided to use it for all the victory point cards, and he had some pink paper for the attack cards. As for theme and a name, he decided to keep it simple. Castle Builder. The game was a smash hit at his game night. Over the coming weeks and months, he kept thinking up new ideas for action cards, 50 of them in all, but for any given game, he only used and tested out 10 of them. It soon became the only game his group wanted to play, even taking over the group's usual Magic the Gathering night. Don tried to move on to work on other designs, but his gaming group didn't care. They wanted more Castle Builder. He knew then that he was onto something. He began to organize the 50 action cards into sets of 10, themed not by narrative or story, but by what their actions did. There was a spendy set that was all about money. There was one all about player interaction. There was one with cards that gave you stuff on your turn and the next turn, and so on. Don realized each set could be an expansion and had a vision of an entire game store shelf made up of his game with all the expansions. And at some point, I guess Castle Builder just became too hard to say, because Donald X. Vaccarino changed the name of his prototype to Dominion, our next game changer. When it came time to sell Castle Builder to a publisher, Vaccarino hit another bump. He had tried showing some earlier designs to Wizards of the Coast, since he was a known quantity there, but they'd passed on all his previous ideas, and by 2006, Garfield himself had stepped back from the company, and Vaccarino, who did not like traveling, did not relish making a trip to Seattle without more assurance that something would come out of it. Instead, Vaccarino looked at his game collection and realized that most of his games had been published by Rio Grande Games, so he decided to pitch his game to them. He looked them up on the internet and emailed them. Within 20 minutes, he had an answer from the owner, Jay Tummelson, saying he'd be willing to hear Vaccarino's pitch, but he only looked at new games at conventions. Vaccarino looked at the convention schedule and saw that they were all bunched up in the summer, with Origins in Columbus, Ohio, being the first one in June. He arranged to meet Jay at Origins the following June in 2007. He pitched the entire set of 10 games. Jay took a month to think it over and ended up saying he would take the base game and one expansion. But Jay also insisted Vaccarino take on one of the Rio Grande playtesters to assist him in balancing and finalizing the Dominion base game and the first expansion, which Vaccarino had dubbed Monster Factory, although it was later retitled Intrigue. Vaccarino finalized the card mixes for the games, trying to suss out which ones were over or underpowered, while his assistant worked on making sure the wording on the cards was problem-free. There was still a lot of work to be done on deciding which action cards should be in which set. Some were flown in from the expansions, like Library, Gardens, and Festival, which were originally part of an expansion called Alchemy, a set which also had a secondary resource called Potions. Others, which had been part of the base set, were then farmed out to the expansions. Then there was the issue of balancing the attack cards. Vaccarino didn't want players to be locked out of the game, so the original every other player must trash the top card of their draw deck was itself trashed in favor of the Thief, which targeted only coin cards. Vaccarino was never totally pleased with it, but time ran out before he could improve on it, and it wasn't until the release of the second edition in 2016 that he replaced the Thief with the Bandit. and a card which forced everyone to discard two cards, which could decimate everyone's hand if it was played multiple times on the same turn, was replaced by Militia, which only forced players to discard down to three. The starting decks also needed a tweak, and eventually Vaccarino settled on each player starting with seven copper cards, each worth a dollar, and three estates, each worth one victory point. He kept the size of the starting deck at 10 because with a hand size of 5, players had two turns to buy cards on their first pass through their decks. Finally, the endgame conditions needed to be re-examined. Vaccarino's playtests had found that players often rushed to buy the mid-value VP card called Duchies because they brought in 3 VPs each, which, while not as valuable as the high-end provinces worth 5 VP, they seemed to be more cost-effective. Vaccarino solved this 3 ways. First, by making provinces worth 6 VP instead of 5, which seemed to tip things in their favor. Second, by changing the game end trigger to the province pile being empty or any 3 other piles being empty. And third, by reducing the number of cards in each pile in the market to 10 from 12, which also had the beneficial effect of reducing the number of cards needed for the game. Dominion was released in October 2008, with Intrigue coming out the following year. Meanwhile, Vaccarino continued to tune the expansions, enlarging the playtest group by writing a computer version which let the game be played online. Richard Garfield himself helped with the Seaside expansion, and Tom Lehman and Weiwa Wang, who were themselves soon to release the very popular Race for the Galaxy, permanently joined the playtest group as of Alchemy. I remember Dominion's release as being quite low-key and without much advance hype or fanfare, it kind of crept into the marketplace and BGG forums. At first, the three biggest curiosities were 1, the fact that the game was, quote, just 500 cards, nothing else, 2, the ugliness of its logo, and 3, its designer, who seemed to spring from nowhere. Word of mouth spread quickly, first in Europe, where it became the talk of the Essen Game Fair in 2008, and then in North America, as reviews from those who had played and bought it in Essen began to post on BGG. Tournament play in local game stores began almost immediately. Dominion's success rested on 3 key pillars. 1, it had a very basic gameplay loop that was easy to teach and understand. On your turn, you had 1 action, which could, depending on which kingdom cards were available, could be comboed into a chain. Then, you bought 1 card, possibly more depending on the action cards you'd played. Then you cleaned up your play area, putting all the cards you'd played and the cards left in your hand into your discard pile. And finally, you drew back up to 5 cards. A for action, B for buy, C for cleanup, D for draw. 2, the endgame and victory conditions were straightforward. Once the province pile or 3 other piles were empty, play continued until everyone had taken the same number of turns, and then the game was over. You counted up the victory points in your deck, and whoever had the most points was the winner. 3rd, and perhaps most important, was Dominion's variability. The market was only ever 10 types of action card, and even the base game had 25 to choose from, which meant that there were 3,268,760 possible sets of market cards, which Vaccarino called kingdoms. And in the first expansion, there were 25 new cards, which meant that the number of possibilities grew to over 10 billion. So there was no automatic best opening move or best strategy because it was the synergy amongst the available actions in any particular set of cards or kingdom which determined optimal play. Victory went to the player who was quickest to figure out this unique synergy and implement it. That's not to say that over time, certain opening moves, particularly the first 2 rounds, became somewhat standardized. If in your first hand of 5 you had 3 coins, you almost always bought a silver instead of an action card. In fact, for a time, some players claimed that that was a dominant strategy, to only buy silvers, and then only golds, and then provinces. The money strategy did indeed perform well a lot of the time. But the key is that it didn't win most of the time, and certainly became less and less dominant as more and more expansions came out. Debates over Dominion strategy soon dominated the hot thread forums on BoardGameGeek, with players arguing with a passion I hadn't seen since the early days of Settlers of Catan. That was helped along by the fact that there was an online German board game platform, Brettspielwelt, or Board Game World, which allowed players to play Dominion for free, which led to huge amounts of data accumulating as hundreds of thousands of matches were played. I was one of those people, racking up over 1,000 plays of Dominion over the first 2 years of its release. Having missed out on Magic the Gathering for reasons I talked about in episode 2, I was bewitched by this game in which the building and evolution of your deck was the entire game. When Dominion was nominated for, and then won, that game's Spiel des Jahres, curiosity about just who this Donald X. Vaccarino was only deepened. Many, it seems, just couldn't believe that a first-time designer had won the Spiel, let alone design a game that deserved to win the Spiel. The fact that Vaccarino appeared to have only set up a BGG account in 2008 and provided little personal information and no photos of himself only seemed to add to the mystery. In the still-growing internet ecosystem, a person's reluctance to leave a digital footprint was beginning to be treated less with respect for their attempt to maintain privacy than the suspicion of what are they hiding. One BGG thread was started by someone who insisted it must be a pseudonym. I mean, he said, Donald X? Mr. X? How much more generic could you get? Belatedly, Vaccarino did emerge from the shadows to assert his existence and claim his well-deserved acclaim. Dominion began to break into public consciousness. Barnes & Noble began to stock it in 2009, where it joined that very exclusive club of tabletop games carried by non-hobby stores. It was spotted on Howard and Bernadette's shelf in The Big Bang Theory. And the inevitable cries of, when is the digital version of this going to happen, began. Here is one place where I think Vaccarino and Rio Grande dropped the ball. As I just mentioned, Dominion had been made available on Germany's Brettspielwelt, but as the expansions began to be released, Rio Grande decided to only make a tiny subset of the new action cards available there because they were working on a proprietary version. And so fans waited. One asked for permission to post his homemade version and was told by Rio Grande that it was okay as long as he didn't use the original artwork from the game. Then he went ahead and did it anyway, earning an annoyed slap on the wrist from Vaccarino. Man, I have other stuff to do, he posted, implying he resented being forced to waste time dealing with petty copyright issues. At least one iOS app and one Android version lasted for a while until, once again, Rio Grande demanded they be withdrawn because of their, quote, imminent official version. Finally, the official version came out in collaboration with software company GoCo. I tried to use the Internet Wayback Machine to pinpoint a specific release date, and the best I could come up with was mid-2015. That's right, a full 7 years after the game hit stores. GoCo's version was pay-to-play, had a clunky interface, a so-so solo campaign system, and terrible online playability. The GoCo servers seemed to continually overload or go down, and after a little over a year, Rio Grande pulled the plug and started over again with a different developer. Finally, at the very end of 2016, a new subscription-based version of Dominion launched, coded by Dutch firm Shuffle IT. It also met with a rocky reception due to its clunky interface, not to mention that not all the old users got the email about transferring their accounts into the new version, although they were given a free year of access. But they were also still going to have to shell out all over again for new subscriptions. It took a couple of years for all this ill will to recede, but the 2020 COVID pandemic spurred many who had sworn off Dominion Online, including me, to revisit the new version, and those that did, like myself, were pleasantly surprised by how much the interface had improved and how reasonable the subscription fees now seemed. Still, when I compare Dominion's rocky online transition with Ticket to Rides, for example, I can't help but wonder what would have happened had Vaccarino and Rio Grande partnered with Days of Wonder and entered the digital realm sooner. I bet Vaccarino wonders too. Dominion's excellence and popularity immediately spurred imitators. Other designers took up Vaccarino's deck-building mechanic. Some simply cut and pasted it into thinly reskinned versions of Dominion. Others tried to put their own twist on it. And still others integrated it into more complex or strongly themed games. In part two, I'll do my best to give you a tour of the deck-building universe as it's evolved over the past 12 years. That was part one of episode 7 of The Game Changers. I'm David Weiss for the Daily Worker Placement. Thanks for listening. See you next time, and don't flip that table.